It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll find out about a new project that aims to break down barriers between veterans and the communities that they return to. We'll hear about the Veterans Coming Home Project.
First, we're just days away from Wisconsin's presidential primary. While the nomination picture is clearer now than in recent weeks, many political observers will be watching Wisconsin's results really closely, especially because historically we've been pretty good at picking the candidates who go on to win their party's nominations.
Philip Bump joins us now. He's a writer for the Washington Post politics blog, The Fix, where he recently wrote about why Wisconsin is good at picking presidential nominees. Philip, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
First of all, you say that the nomination process is pretty stupid, but it's what we've got. Why do you think it's stupid?
Well, I had forgotten that I said that as explicitly, so I will now own up to it. Essentially, it's stupid just because it's a giant mess, right? I mean, normally, the party sort of backfilled this process of having primaries and having caucuses that directly relate to who the nominee is going to be because people were mad that the party was just sort of picking the nominee at the convention. So it's sort of dumb the way they do it because they still sort of expect there will be a consensus candidate, that person will win. The Republican Party has all these different systems that it uses in all these different states with the anticipation they're going to end up with like a Mitt Romney, who's someone everyone can agree on. So it's not prepared for a situation like this year when everything is totally messy and dramatic because the process wasn't built to actually be a streamlined one.
So as you point out, it is the process that we have. We have to make the best of it. And Wisconsin is taking its part in the primary process next Tuesday.
Right.
And you took a look. You wanted to see who has the most influence or who actually gets it right when it comes to picking candidates. And, you know, here in Wisconsin, this year we kind of matter, but that certainly isn't always the case. It seems like usually everything is kind of wrapped up with a bow on it by the time you get to Wisconsin. With those early states, you know, Iowa and some of the more eastern states. So how do they do at picking the eventual nominee, the early states?
Well, the early states, I mean, it's tougher for them, right? Because so Iowa was presented this year, for example, with 12 different candidates. Wisconsin has 3, right? And so when you have odds like that, so when you're always going early, you always have more candidates who you can choose from who will end up not being the nominee. So they sort of have that working against them to some extent. But on the other hand, states like Montana, which you tend to go very late in the process, has a worse record than does Wisconsin. So there's something about Wisconsin in particular where Wisconsin has been better able to predict on both sides, both Republican and Democratic sides, who the nominee is going to be.
So who is, before we get to the best,
sure,
drum roll there, but who is the worst at predicting?
Alaska, actually. Alaska, again, usually comes somewhere in the middle, but they had a very bad run from 1976 to 1996 where they only picked one proper nominee. They've done better since then, but yeah, that's just, you know, we're not talking about that many contests either, right? It's only really two handfuls of presidential nomination contests. So if you get a couple of them wrong, then you're basically out of the running on best state.
But, you know, even given that, Wisconsin looks pretty good. In fact, Wisconsin is the best at predicting the eventual nominees. What does our track record look like?
Well, you guys have only gotten one wrong, and I think it's very funny that you've only gotten one wrong. The one you got wrong was 1984, when you guys, unlike most of the Midwest, decided against Walter Mondale. And I like to think that's just the traditional rivalry, Minnesota versus Wisconsin. But Wisconsin picked Gary Hart. That's the only one since 1968 that Wisconsin has not picked the nominee for either side.
Yeah, Gary Hart was pretty wrong. And you also point out that when it comes to hometown advantage, that's when states can kind of mar their record a little bit when it comes to choosing.
Exactly. I mean, I tried to give states a pass, you know, Tom Harkin in 1992 in Iowa, right? I mean, like, of course, Iowa is going to vote for Tom Harkin in 1992, even though he didn't really have much of a shot over the long run. So, you know, I looked at it both ways, both for people who were including home state misses and, you know, excluding those. Either way, Wisconsin was still the best state at it.
Any other takeaways that you've gotten from this about how states actually do when it comes to predicting?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty remarkable. I mean, keep in mind that usually in most non-crazy years, which this year happens to be one of the crazy ones, you usually get your nominee fairly early in the process, then all the other states just give them a thumbs up, right? Despite that, though, there still are a lot of states that have a lot of misses, which means that these contests have gone deep enough into the cycle that people are still voting and still voting for who they would like to see be the nominee and having that not be the case, which I thought was interesting because we tend to think of these usually as being sort of acclimation processes, but that turned out not to be the case.
And what about the middle of the pack groups of states? Were there any surprises there when you looked?
Not particularly. You know, I mean, most of them were generally about in the same range. You know, there were a few that got them really wrong, like Alaska did. I mean, Alaska's only gotten it right about a little over a third of the time. But for the most part, it's generally pretty consistent, right? I mean, most states usually get it right, occasionally don't, with, you know, a few rare exceptions.
So since the sample size is, as you point out, it's pretty small, does this actually matter at all? Is this worth anything when we think about Wisconsin's place?
It is worth bragging rights, and that's about the best I can offer. You know, I mean, it is certainly not the case that whoever wins Wisconsin is going to win the nomination. I mean, look at this year, right? New polling suggests it's going to be Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders, and neither of them is likely to be his party's nominee. So actually, your record may go down the tubes here this year. But I would not use this if I were a betting person. I would not head down to the casino and put money on this.
Well, we're talking to Philip Bump right now, writer for the Washington Post politics blog, The Fix. And we've been talking to him about why Wisconsin has historically been number one when it comes to picking presidential nominees. We only got one wrong, and that was Carrie Hart in 84. And I know, Philip, that you've also been writing about that contested convention scenario.
Right.
And what might happen if a nominee, you know, talking here on the GOP side, if a nominee has a plurality of delegates, has got a lead in the delegates, what might happen when we look through the lens of history? What do we know?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, again, and I have to go back to this point that this convention process is controlled by the party. This is not really meant to be a democratic process. And so if you look back over history at all the times that on the first ballot no one has had a majority of the delegates, most of the time the people who come in and on that first ballot are in first place, they end up not getting the nomination. Someone comes in from behind them and passes them. And I think there's a reason for that, which is that those people weren't popular enough to actually get the nomination. It may have been in a lot of cases like this year when the establishment didn't want that person to win, but they had still done a good job of getting delegates together. But then they get passed at the convention itself. So it suggests that if Donald Trump goes to the convention, has a plurality of delegates but not the majority, historically speaking, he would be more likely than not to not be the nominee.
I'm processing that statement. So, yeah, not good news in that case for Donald Trump is essentially what you're saying if you look through the lens of history. And if you go back to the 1800s, it sounds as though this is a scenario which actually did happen a few times.
Yeah, there have been some really, I mean, when you talk about contested, there's contested and then there's contested. And there have been some times that there have been a lot of votes that have been taken. If you look, for example, at 1912, the Democrats had 46 different ballots before they ended up with Woodrow Wilson as their nominee. If you look at 1924, the Democrats went to 103 ballots and ended up losing that presidential race. I mean, this can go on and on and on. Of course, most of this happened in the era pre even radio, right? I mean, this happened in a pre-mass media environment. This year will be different from the standpoint that the RNC wants to do what it wants to do. The Republicans want to have this convention play out to the benefit of the party, but there's going to be a lot of people paying attention to it, a lot of Trump supporters paying attention to it. So it's going to be harder for them to enact their will sort of by fiat because they're going to have all these eyes on them.
Right. We have candidates who are very active, their campaigns on platforms like Twitter and Facebook. And do you think that could put pressure on the delegates besides whoever might be twisting their arms at the convention?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, but it's so hard to predict because this is outside of the realm of what we've seen recently. I think that the RNC probably, and they could even do this before the convention arrives, but I think that they will go out of their way to make sure it is as smooth a process as possible. But that's not the path that Ted Cruz, for example, is taking. Ted Cruz has done a very good job of organizing these individual delegates themselves, the people who will be in that room, so that even if they have to vote for Donald Trump on the first ballot, he wants people in that room who, if on the second ballot, if they are released to vote for whoever they want to by the rules, they will vote for Ted Cruz. There's a lot of stuff going on in the background here, so it's very hard to predict what might happen.
Philip, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Philip Bump, writer for the Washington Post politics blog, The Fix. He joined us there to talk about why Wisconsin has historically been number one when it comes to picking presidential nominees. We also talked a bit about the scenario of a contested convention and how likely that person with the plurality of delegates is likely to get the nomination. Answer, not very.
Well, and this could really change the statistics if somebody, you know, who was approved by no states. Paul Ryan or Mitt Romney are names that have been thrown around. That means that zero states would be right on the Republican side. So very different numbers possible next year.
A new multimedia project launched this week that our colleagues at Wisconsin Public Television are involved with. The Veterans Coming Home Project hopes to break down some of the barriers and misunderstandings that exist between people who have served in the military and civilians.
Garrett Combs is a U.S. Army combat veteran who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's now a photographer and filmmaker. And Michael Primo is a filmmaker, multi-platform storyteller, photographer, activist, and organizer. Judith Sears-Poisson spoke with them when they were in Wisconsin earlier this month.
Garrett, Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Let's start out with having you tell us about the Veterans Returning Home Project. Michael, how did you get involved and what's it about for you?
I heard about this project last fall. I was approached by Kindling Group, the production company, that was interested in doing a really dynamic, digital-first project, meaning that the content would be designed for the web and would be a really unique and unprecedented opportunity to have a really serious conversation about the nature of service, what it means to serve, and what that service is in relationship to citizenship, and to talk about the unique similarities and differences between the military life and people who have never participated actively in the military.
And Garrett, you are a combat veteran. How did you get involved and what is your role in this project?
A friend of mine showed me this project and I, you know, contacted the staff and I was really interested in it because I've had a pretty personal experience and I had a difficult transition myself and have had, you know, have watched a number of my friends have the same or have a difficult time coming through to the civilian world, and I wanted to kind of be a part of hopefully examining and breaking down this idea that there is a divide between military and civilian, and having an opportunity to travel across the country and talk to like dozens, if not, I don't know, hundreds of people, I think will be the best way to do that. And on a digital platform like this, could have a pretty big impact on starting like a public conversation about this issue.
And Garrett, what do you think is the hardest thing for civilians to understand about the experience that people who have served, especially those that have been in combat, have experienced?
I think it's important for civilians to understand that the experience is unique for every individual, and that when someone goes into the military, they bring a lot of their past history with them. So the experience of the military and then furthermore, the experience of combat is going to affect every person differently. So to say, you know, or to assume that all veterans are damaged in a set particular way isn't correct. And I think that's one of the things is to understand that each experience is unique.
And Michael, you are a civilian. Obviously, you're interested in these issues because you're working on this project. But have some of the things that have come up, the themes that have arisen in the interviews and the discussions, have you realized that you've actually had some of those misconceptions?
Yeah, I think in part. I mean, I think what's fascinating about working on this project so far is that our team, there's five of us that are sort of producing and directing this content. Three are veterans and two are civilians like myself. And there are certainly misconceptions that are kind of influenced by what I might see in movies or the news. But, you know, when you really have the opportunity to sit down and talk to someone, you begin to really understand the similarities. And I think that's kind of something that's exciting. And the similarities across society, like, you know, there are plenty of civilians who, though their situation is completely different than combat veterans, the issues of emotional vulnerability, of trauma, of mental and emotional health are not exclusive to just people who serve in the military.
And Garrett, I'm interested to know whether you think that there are any things that veterans have a hard time understanding about people who have lived a purely civilian life. Are there some of those misconceptions and misunderstandings that go the other direction?
Yeah, there is. I like to say that veterans need to take as much initiative, if not more, in their own healing and their own integration into, you know, our society as the civilians who want to help them integrate. And part of that effort is to start understanding that we're coming back to a society that may not understand your experience, but that doesn't mean that your experience is better, and it doesn't mean that they haven't experienced something themselves. So part of this project is to examine some of the stereotypes that are on both sides, and then see where we can start to draw similarities, like Mike was saying. And I have fallen into the trap of feeling, you know, like I am in some way better or have more life experience or know more than your, you know, quote unquote average civilian because I experienced combat. So when you can let go of that ego, you can start to, you know, embrace the world around you and, you know, cultivate meaningful relationships with people who don't have that same experience as you, but who you can create new experiences with.
We're talking with Michael Primo and Garrett Combs about their involvement in the project, which is called Veterans Returning Home. And we are talking about their experiences working with veterans and with civilians on breaking down the barriers between those two groups. Now, Garrett, you referenced a little earlier that you had a difficult transition back to civilian life. And I did read that you lost your faith because of what you saw during your time on active duty. Can you share some of those struggles with us?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I refer to faith, it's more of a worldview. A lot of the reason that I joined was, you know, very kind of stereotypical, like for God and country. And when I got over to talk about similarities and differences, when I got over to Afghanistan, and you would think that all you would be able to see are the differences, but when I started to just examine just the act of being human and how simple some of those people's lives are and how free of clutter and crap their lives are, other than the war that's going on around them, it started to help me shape my worldview in a new way. And then when I saw how devastating these wars have been on the civilian populations over there and on my own friends and the people that I served with, I began to really examine my worldview, my faith, as you're referring to it. And it changed the way that I thought and the way that I viewed the human experience in a pretty significant way.
I know that you considered yourself very patriotic when you enlisted in the military.
You seem to know a lot about me.
do you feel like your definition of patriotism may have changed during your service?
Yeah, absolutely. Working on this project with people like Mike and Kathleen, who's the other civilian, I'm doing air quotes, has really helped me understand that, like, you don't have to join the military to be a patriot, and you don't even have to, you know, align with one political view or one way of thinking to be a patriot, and that being a patriot comes in a number of shapes and sizes based on your life experience and the adversities that you face in your community and in this country.
You've both been traveling around talking with people, hearing their experiences for this series. Michael, as someone who is a civilian, what's it like for you to help document the journeys of these veterans?
Well, I think what's exciting and unique about this project is we're not just looking at the veterans alone, but we're looking at the relationship between people who haven't served and the military. And it's been amazing to sort of sit and talk with these folks. We had the kind of extreme pleasure of sitting in this woman's house yesterday in the evening, talking for what felt like hours. I could talk to her for days. And, you know, something that came up was this topic of emotional vulnerability and how whether or not you're in the military or whether you're not in the military, but we as a society, and especially in a very patriarchal, masculine society, this notion of emotional vulnerability is not something that we think about. It's not something that we talk about. But it's an obstacle to our own mental and emotional health, whether or not you served in the military or you didn't serve. And I think identifying that, yes, there are definitely unique, significant differences, but there are those each difference is met with a parallel similarity. And that's kind of what's amazing.
And Garrett, it sounds like you were struck with the common humanity of the people that you met in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it sounds like you're having a similar experience talking with civilians here back home. Has this project helped you in any way with your healing and your recovery?
Well, this project is really new, so it's been a pretty immersive experience so far, and yes, it has started to kind of like shape my understanding of what I thought the divide was. But I mean, I think just being a filmmaker and an artist and a photographer and just spending days walking around, like asking people on the street if I can take their picture, was what helped me to really find some healing and connect with my world. And that's a thing, like, veterans are known for isolating when they get back because they feel misunderstood and they feel alone and they've been cut off from their brotherhood. And like a lot of people experience those feelings. And it takes engaging with the world to start to be able to move past that.
Well, Michael and Garrett, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
That was Garrett Combs, a U.S. Army veteran, combat veteran who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Michael Primo, a filmmaker, photographer, and multimedia storyteller. They're part of the Veterans Coming Home Project. Judith Sears-Poisson spoke with them when they were in Wisconsin earlier this month. You can learn more about the project at their website. It's veteranscominghome.org.
Coming up, we'll find out how this week's Supreme Court 4-4 tie decision is affecting both laws and maybe the political future. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talked to WPR reporters for a firsthand look at the Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders rallies in Wisconsin yesterday.
First, a U.S. Supreme Court decision this week had a major impact on a labor law challenge with national implications. Or maybe it was a Supreme Court non-decision with the 8-member court evenly divided.
The 4-4 tie demonstrates how the unfilled vacancy on the High Court may affect laws in the future, including a challenge to the Affordable Care Act's mandate on contraceptive coverage.
Joining us for a closer look is political science professor Kimmy King at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, good to have you back.
Hey, good to be back.
Well, before we get to the broader implications, let's take a look at this, one of the first big cases to come to the Supreme Court now that it's an 8-member Supreme Court. Talk us through this labor law challenge.
Well, this in essence dealt with the ability of public sector employees to opt out of the union. And you know, in a number of states, not Wisconsin's, yours is separate from that, but I believe it's in 21 states, there's a requirement that unions can also charge non-union members for what they call chargeable fees. And it's in essence a way of recognizing that unions may bargain collectively and get benefits for non-union members, and they want to be able to get their share of that money and the benefit. And so, in essence, the court's divided opinion is considered a victory for organized labor, which looked like it was set to lose because they didn't have that 9 justice. Any time you have a Supreme Court decision in which there's a tie vote, the tie goes to whoever won at the last level. And so because organized labor had won at the last level, it's going to leave a victory for them in place. The larger question is, where do we go from here? Because we have a number of cases, class actions, capital sentencing, juvenile justice, abortion, affirmative action, contraception, immigration, jury selection, voting rights, that are all in the balance. And these are the most pivotal issues of our day. This is exactly the kind of thing that all the candidates are out there debating about. So do we just sit tight for a year while we have a divided court?
And I want to tackle one of those issues you just mentioned, where we saw kind of a weird thing out of the court, contraceptive coverage, a challenge to the contraceptive coverage mandate under the Affordable Care Act. There's a religious liberty-based challenge to it. Now, you mentioned that in the case of a tie, the lower court, whatever their last decision won, just rides. It stays in effect. This is one where different courts have had different decisions. So a tie vote, if it came out that way, means the law works differently in one part of the country and differently in another part of the country.
That's correct. And we've talked several times in the past about the past patchwork quilt that is constitutional law. And that's one of the issues that are so interesting about this particular case. It's the Zubik versus Burwell case, in which there's an evaluation of whether contraception coverage and that requirement, which is under the Affordable Care Act, requires religiously affiliated institutions like schools, Catholic hospitals, that feel very strongly that they do not want to provide either certain types of contraception or contraception in general for religious reasons. Must be they be mandated to do so. So the Obama administration had tried to work out avoiding the requirement under the Affordable Care Act by saying they could fill out a form, but a number of institutions felt like that still violated their religious principles. So without that ninth justice, it seems fairly clear, given where the justices are coming ideologically, that it's going to sustain some of the accommodation to those religious groups and organizations, but not all. So that means the law is going to be one thing in one circuit and another in another circuit, and that's problematic.
And so the Supreme Court did something a little weird here. They asked for, or as I understand it, this is unusual, they said, hey, both sides, we want a rebriefing. We want you to get more info, and hey, take a look at this idea just hypothetically. That's unusual, right?
It is unusual for them to do a rebriefing, but it is not so surprising given Chief Justice John Roberts' leadership. Remember, he is the critical member in the case which upheld the Affordable Care Act and its constitutionality, which said that Congress did have the authority under its taxing and spending clause powers to establish the Affordable Care Act. He sided with the liberals on that, but then he sided with the conservatives on the Commerce Clause issues. So he really indicated in that opinion that he was standing right on the edge of the bridge and saying, I am not going to be the one that makes this call. In fact, in his opinion, he points out that there's an upcoming election and that there will be a possibility to speak on that. And then in the 2012 election, Obama won. So it's possible that Roberts is trying to say, we are not going to sit here and twiddle our thumbs for the remaining 300-plus days while Congress gets its political act together.
Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas about our U.S. Supreme Court, our 8-member U.S. Supreme Court, a 4-4 tie and a key issue, prospect for lots more of them to come. So, Kimmy, is this going to leave a lot of things in effect in limbo if people can't persuade a 5-3 majority on a lot of these issues?
Well, the question is, we have, for example, the affirmative action decision, which was argued in December, and that deals with a race-conscious program. That's not even a 4-4 decision. That's a 7-member court because Kagan had to recuse herself, having been part of the Obama Justice Department before her appointment. This has been a case that's been working its way through the court for years, through the court system. And so it's not even 4-4 there, right? But all of those issues that I read to you before, I mean, most interestingly, the issue of abortion, which, as we saw yesterday, is back on the national agenda with everyone talking about it. The case of Whole Woman's Health versus Cole that will take Texas abortion clinics down from more than 40 to almost 10 because of restrictions that were put on it by the Texas legislature. That's the one that everybody's watching closely, and in addition to the contraception case, but that one in particular. And what will happen there is that the clinics will close. So that's going to be an interesting forcing of that decision.
Now, in addition to this 4-4 issue, another big change is that Antonin Scalia is no longer there. I saw a quote from law professor Erwin Chemerinsky in USA Today saying none of them, the other justices, has ever been on the court without Justice Scalia. And I guess it's emerging that he is the guy who led the way on questioning. He's the guy who crystallized opinions for the people who agreed with him and the people who disagreed. Like, what he said let them know, in effect, what they were arguing about. They're kind of at loose ends in some ways, aren't they?
You know, that's actually a really fascinating point about the role of Scalia as kind of the godfather, right, of the Supreme Court, because love him or hate him, virtually everybody had the highest level of respect for his opinions and his judicial integrity. And while he could alienate people, you know, he was notorious for alienating Kennedy and O'Connor, it will be curious to see the role that more senior members take on, like Kennedy. And I would suggest to you that where you're going to want to look is the role that Kennedy plays in a number of these decisions. Kennedy was a critical person back in the in a case in the 1990s that undercut abortion, or basically allowed the states to regulate more heavily abortion. And Kennedy departed from his kind of Catholic orthodoxy to be able to narrowly craft an opinion. So there's some thinking here that Kennedy is doing some of that behind-the-scenes work, that he is starting to pick up the mantle of where Scalia might have left off.
And this, of course, is all happening against this backdrop of the effort to put a new ninth member of the court, Merrick Garland, the president's nominee. Some limited thawing in the Senate as far as at least some Republican senators being willing not to have a hearing, not to vote on him, but to talk to the guy in person. What are we seeing there?
Well, you know, you actually, it's interesting enough, you are starting to see some movement in that regard, which I think most people a couple of weeks ago would have been surprised about. Part of the reason why that started happening was because there was a public opinion poll out where two-thirds of Americans indicated that they wanted the court to at least look at a nominee. And I think that that's part of what's contributing to it. So you've seen Susan Collins of Maine, John Boozman of Arkansas, both say that they are going to plan on meetings. But then you have other GOP offices who are reaching out to, you know, Lankford from Oklahoma, Inhofe from Oklahoma have also said they will reach out. You've got aides from Republicans in New Hampshire and West Virginia. And I think that part of what is starting to roll is that the increased level of tension within the Republican Party over the Trump-Cruz spat that is going on is forcing Republicans to look deep in their districts and try to in their states and try to evaluate what is going to happen to me and where do I need to throw my political fate, and is this the issue that I'm really willing to take a stand on? And I think that's why you're starting to see Republican movement.
We're talking right now with political science professor Kimmy King about this week's Supreme Court deadlock, how the ongoing vacancy is affecting court cases on high-profile issues.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think that the vacancy on the court should be filled as soon as possible, or does this latest decision demonstrate to you that we should wait until the next president is elected? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation about how the current vacancy on the Supreme Court is affecting court cases in labor laws, contraceptive coverage, and more.
University of North Texas political science professor Kimmy King stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Senate should meet with the candidate for the court, vote on the candidate, approve the candidate, or should it wait for the next election or for the next president to be in place? Does the makeup of the court concern you? Is it something that you vote on in the election? Do you think it's leaned too far left or right? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Kimmy, we heard from a Buzz on Facebook who says the fact that the Senate is not considering the nominee is dereliction of their duty. And Buzz says, so is the behavior of Democratic senators from Wisconsin that ran to Illinois rather than do their duty. So that's a little while back in Wisconsin history. But he's making himself out to be somebody who will judge based on performance, not on ideology. Is there among voters, do you think, Kimmy, a lot of people who think, I'm not worried about this as a Republican or a Democrat. I have a view on how the job should be done?
I think that's right. And remember, we're going to continue paying everybody their salaries regardless of whether anything gets done. Meanwhile, we are literally looking at millions of dollars in litigation that will be, in essence, put on hold or perhaps lost. You will continue to see other cases come forward. It really does create difficulty. I think one of the things to go back to Kennedy before that's interesting is that this idea of having somebody be nominated and confirmed in an election year, has long been a political volleyball. I mean, you know, Obama, Biden, they have all done this in the past, raising the specter of concerns about the appointment in election years. The fact of the matter is, Justice Kennedy himself was nominated in 1987, but then was confirmed in 1988, an election year. We have a number of instances going back in history where opposition-controlled Congresses have managed to get their act together and reach a consensus candidate. And I really think that that's kind of the interesting thing about what President Obama did by nominating Garland, is that he's such a centrist. In some ways, one of the reasons why you see support for people like the person who sent you the message is that, you know, Garland is really kind of an ideal candidate for Republicans in an otherwise catchy time. Do you wait and be concerned about a Hillary Clinton nominee or a Trump nominee? Or do you take this guy now and hope that he's someone that can be turned, right? Because that happens.
Let's go to our callers now, starting with Dennis on the line in Ripon. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I always hear the Republican senators saying that they want the American people to have a say in the nominee or how it goes. But the American people already had a say when they elected those senators, and they should stand up and do their job.
Dennis, thanks for the call. And that's what a lot of people are saying and arguing, that President Obama was elected and still president. Is that going to carry water, though, Kemi?
It's interesting. I do think it's a function of the leadership, and the point that your caller is making is actually also part of the reason why the Republican Party is struggling just a little bit. It's this idea that there is a select group of establishment members who are leadership, who are calling the shots on policy. That's why a Ted Cruz rose up. He rose up to challenge the establishment. And so that's part of what this negative energy with people being unhappy about the Senate not going ahead and moving this forward. That's where this is coming from.
Do you think as the Donald Trump campaign goes on, if it becomes clear that he is the Republican nominee, that's maybe the time that Republicans say, okay, that's a wild card, let's take, as you mentioned, this more centrist candidate and versus the liberal that a Democrat would do, or the who knows what Trump might do?
Yeah, it's kind of a deal or no deal, right?
Yeah.
You're getting to a point with a deal of no deal. You know, all bets are off with Trump. I think that one of the reasons, you know, in terms of making a call on where that's going to go, one of the things that I think is really interesting and why you're seeing some shift inside the Republicans being willing to at least have their aides negotiate a possibility of a meeting with Garland is there's a third tack here that you could take, and that is, as a centrist Republican, you look like you're not giving in to the establishment Republican Party. You agree and push forward to the hearings. You grill him nonstop. And at the end of the day, remember, they're going to have 14 additional votes in order to get him confirmed. And that creates a real possibility that you could have some behind-the-scenes political shenanigans, that you could drag this out, see if it's going to be Cruz or Trump, and then play your hand accordingly. And that may be what you're starting to see with some of your more moderate Republicans.
We'll bring on another caller now. Katie is with us in Clinton. Katie, hi.
Hi. I usually, when I do my voting, I will look at both candidates. I don't normally go Republican or Democratic. I look at the candidates. And if I've got two candidates that are fairly even, I will go towards the one that will vote for a Supreme Court justice. So in case in point, I'm looking at Feingold and Johnson. Johnson has already come out and said he will not support any hearings or anything. I will go Feingold.
Katie, thanks a lot for the call. Kimmy, just a few moments. Do you think there are a lot of voters in tight Senate races like ours in Wisconsin who are thinking that way?
What your caller said is absolutely excellent, and I think that it is a very good point that senators are trying to weigh the calculus on. Yes, I think it will be a determining point. It's also because I think your caller is tapping into that frustration that it's time for the do-nothing Senate, the do-nothing House to start doing something rather than saying they're just going to continue waiting.
We'll leave it there for now. As always, Kemi, good to talk to you.
Great to see you. Take it easy.
That's the University of North Texas political science professor Kimmy King. She joins today to look at some recent deadlocked votes at the U.S. Supreme Court, what the 4-4 tie means, and, of course, the politics of the current nomination on the table for that court.
The candidates for state Supreme Court say they would both carry out their duties without bias if elected next Tuesday. At the same time, they're sending partisan hints to their likely supporters in this officially nonpartisan race. In our first of two profiles, Sean Johnson has this report on appeals court judge Joanne Kloppenburg.
Joanne Kloppenburg could say nothing at all on this campaign, and there would still be some Democratic voters who know she's their candidate in Tuesday's election. This is Kloppenburg's second try for the Supreme Court. She ran her first campaign in 2011 when the election got hyper-politicized, swept up in the fight over Governor Scott Walker's collective bargaining law. It put so much focus on the Supreme Court race that Jesse Jackson came to Wisconsin for get-out-the-vote rallies the day before the election.
When we vote tomorrow, you make Dr. King happy.
Kloppenburg's explicit message in 2011 was the same as it is now. She's running for the court because she's impartial. But at nearly every campaign stop this year, she also takes a shot at Governor Walker and at her opponent, Justice Rebecca Bradley.
I was elected to the Court of Appeals. I owe my judicial career to the people of Wisconsin. Rebecca Bradley owes her judicial career to Governor Walker.
Governor Walker appointed Bradley to the Circuit Court, the Appeals Court, and the State Supreme Court. Every time Kloppenburg brings up the connection, former Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Gieske says she's sending a message.
Clearly, I think she's signaling that, you know, unless you want somebody on the bench who's simply going to do what the Republicans want her to do, you know, you want me.
There's nothing explicitly partisan about Kloppenburg's biography, but there's a lot that liberals might like in the stuff that she highlights. Kloppenburg served in the Peace Corps, and she prosecuted environmental cases with the State Department of Justice. When asked to name a decision she authored that demonstrates her judicial philosophy, Kloppenburg mentioned State v. Crute.
And this involved issuing citations to groups that were gathering in the Capitol over a three-month period in 2013.
Kloppenburg ruled in favor of anti-Walker protesters in that case, which was a blow to the governor's administration. Kloppenburg has donated money to Democrats, and she's supported by Democratic-leaning groups like unions and the Wisconsin Association for Justice, which represents trial lawyers. Association past President Christine Bremer Moogley says Kloppenburg has the intellectual backbone for the job.
She will have an open mind and will be thorough and will be prepared and will not be partisan in her decision-making.
On the U.S. Supreme Court, Kloppenburg says she admires Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor, who were both appointed by Democratic presidents. During a recent debate, Bradley said that sent a negative signal that Kloppenburg would let her personal feelings influence her decisions.
My opponent has a judicial philosophy that is starkly different from mine that will allow her to introduce her personal policy preferences and the type of outcome that she wants to achieve into her judicial decision making.
While Kloppenburg disputed that, she focused her response, as she has all year, on bringing it back to Bradley's background.
My opponent was appointed by Governor Scott Walker three times to three judgeships in 3 years.
In debates and elsewhere, Kloppenburg has said very little about how she would have decided some of the big cases that have come before the Supreme Court, from Act 10 to voter ID. But in between the subtle and not-so-subtle hints this campaign, voters may have an easy time connecting the dots. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tune in tomorrow for part two of our series on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court race when we take a closer look at Justice Rebecca Bradley.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we talk to two WPR reporters who covered the Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders campaign events yesterday. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.